Here's another inspiring speech recorded at Communities in Control, Australia's biggest and best annual community sector gathering.
It's fantastic to be here, and it's just wonderful to see so many people here. I was saying in my office there's going to be about 1,500 people, and they said it sounds more like a rally, and I think it is more like a rally than a conference, which is fantastic. And I'd also like to acknowledge that we're meeting on the land of the Kulin Nation and pay respects to their elders past and present. And also to pay respect to Pat Turner, who just given us such a wonderful insight to what kind of passion can help you live with such horrible injustice. It was just fantastic. What I want to do this morning is, first of all, talk a little bit about local and global experience I'm going to draw on today, then look a little bit at some of the ideas and principles and theories underpinning what I say. I want to give you some practical examples. And then finally, I just want to suggest what are the new ways of thinking. In lots of ways, they're not new ways. They're a return to old ways of thinking about how we can get a sustainable, healthy and convivial future. Now, the title, Not in My Backyard, this term sort of become somewhat negative, hasn't it? We think, you know, it's people who say, oh, well, I don't want this development in my neighbourhood or town, and that could refer to all sorts of things that are being developed. This morning in the lift, I met a man who said, how are you? And I said, oh, it's a good day, I'm going to speak at a conference. And he said, I've got to go and sell wind farms. And I said, oh, that sounds like a really good thing to do. And he said, but nobody wants them in their backyard, which I thought was, and that really happened in the hotel lid. So there we go. So it struck me that it does have these kind of negative overtones and selfishness, but I want to pose the question of, are there unwanted developments from globalisation that are bad for the health and well-being of communities? And I'm going to say, yes, there are. I don't think that's controversial. But then I'm going to think about, can local action overcome these? And are there aspects of globalisation that can actually help our local actions? And in doing this, I'm going to draw on four main lots of experience, which is a lot of the things that drive the passion in my life. One is this commission that I've had the privilege of serving on for the last 3 years. Just 10 days ago, we finally signed off on the final report, and I think when it comes out in September, people will be very pleased to see that it has such a strong focus on social justice and human rights. I've also been involved with a group called the People's Health Movement since it was formed in 2000, and that's a group that really links local action with global issues, and I'll talk a bit about that. I've worked in with the community health movement, as Rhonda said, looking at research and evaluation and evidence for community health for many years now, since the early 80s. And I think it's a wonderful movement, and I think it's got lots to offer us. And I'm sure, how many people here work in community health? I'm sure there's quite a few of you, yeah. And then finally, I'd like to talk about my own local residents' association, because I think it's pretty good. But first of all, ideas, principles and theories. I don't want to be here. A colleague of mine in Canada has defined an academic as someone who sees something working in practice and wonders if it'll work in theory. So I hope I'm not going to be too like that, but I think sometimes it is useful. As Kurt Lewin said, there's nothing so practical as a good theory. So let's just think about that. So in terms of globalisation, there are good and bad things about it. I mean, global villages, we're all benefiting from that. The communications, travel, transport, it's easier, faster and more connected. That may not last. You know, petrol prices, travel, this, we may have just been through an era of wonderful ability to be able to travel around the world. But of course, the internet has offered us all sorts of connections, and everyone here would have a story about that. There's fashions, cultures, some of which sharing cultures is wonderful. Lots of doubts, though, about what people have dubbed Mac culture, a sort of homogenization of a North American culture. There's also many health concerns. I work in a public health department. People are always talking about biosecurity, you know, how quickly a pandemic would go. There's much global economic integration, and there's lots of concerns, I think, about what's happening globally, what's happening to the way in which we organise our economy and what kind of ideas about economics are dominating the world. And there's also lots of questions about global regimes of governance, and I'll certainly come back to that. And of course, the global environment, whatever happens in our local communities is now, we cannot ignore the global. You know, we hear all the time about warming of the atmosphere, the way we're degrading our natural environments. And as I think a friend of, I think, both Rhonda and I, Ilona Kickbush, has said, good planets are hard to find, and there aren't many more of them. So there's absolutely no doubt that we're being strongly linked. The thing that bothers me most in terms of health, I think, is this thing called economic globalization. And I haven't got time to do that in detail, but it's about trade liberalization, dropping tariffs, international trade is increasing rapidly, capital's moving very fast around the world, there's huge investments, people moving money around from one market to another, speculating, and there's a set of global institutions to regulate this, supposedly the World Trade Organization, very complicated international agreements such as the General Agreement on Tariff and Trades and on services. And primarily the net result of all this is that the economy really takes precedent over environmental protection and many social events. So as usual, Lunig sort of, I think, has captured this very well. We're kind of all expected to march in response to the dollar. But the question is, what room does that leave for community solidarity, conviviality, and collective action? So, and I think there's a lot of unease around the world. As I work in different countries in the world, you can hear the same concerns about we're losing control. All our governments are ever worried about is the dollar. You know, why don't we look at happiness rather than wealth and so on? And I think it's a really important concern because one of the other things that's happened with inequities is that they appear to be growing around the world, both between countries, so say between us in the rich countries and poor countries, particularly in Africa, and also growing within countries. Sometimes the evidence isn't that clear, but the overall trend is towards an increasing number of inequities. And of course, Raymond Arons, the famous sociologist, has said, if they get too great, then the idea of community becomes impossible. And it seems to me that that's a very strong warning to us all. Because while people work in a community level, you might think, what's the economy got to do with me? It's got very much to do with us. And I'll talk a bit more about why that's the case. And I'm particularly interested in health inequities because I work in a school of medicine, I work with public health and health promotion and community health people. And overall, the picture is good in the world. Health is improving in most regions of the world, although in some places in Africa, some countries have lost nearly 20 years of life expectancy in the last 15 years as a result of the HIV crisis. In some of the former Soviet republics, health is going back. And for the first time ever, last week I read a report from the US in a very reputable journal that showed that in some parts of the US, females are now losing years of life expectancy. And that's the first time in a rich country since the Second World War. And I think that's people have been predicting it, but we now have the data to show that in some counties in the US, in fact, quite a number of counties, women are losing life expectancy. And that's been put down to, it's not exactly clear why, it's likely to be a range of social determinants and which lead to different lifestyle factors. The distribution of wealth is becoming less equal, and usually when that happens, health will then suffer. And it's clear that inequity is bad for social cohesion and well-being. That's partly, Frank Stilwell and colleague have said very clearly that when we think about our happiness, we judge it as relative to other people. That's what we do, I think, as people. We're always making relative judgments. And if there is widespread economic inequity, then it's a recipe for widespread social discontent. And they conclude that the redress of economic inequality is central to the achievement of a good society. And I think the important message there, and one that we've taken on board on our commission, is that equity is good for all of us. You know, it's good for rich people, it's good for poor people. In the long term, it's going to be good for rich countries and poor countries. And just, I didn't want to go through a lot of statistics, but I think this is a fairly telling one. And this is the CEO cash remunerations compared to average adult earnings. And what you'll see is, whereas around 1990, there was a ratio of 18 to 1 of full-time between full-time rates and those that a CEO got. By 2004-05, that difference was 63 to 1. Now, you know, this is where I think I would say to our corporate colleagues, philanthropy's great, but what about these figures? And I think we have to think about that too. The other thing I think about these data, and it's a bit like how Pat said the problem for Indigenous people is a problem for non-Indigenous people. I worry that the community sector always puts the lens on poverty. For me, poverty is the end result of a maldistribution of wealth, so why don't we put the lens on wealth and think about wealth and its distribution? It's a crucial question of how equal we are. In public health, there's an increasing, what I'd call an epidemiology of inequality. And generally, that epidemiology is showing that the more equal a society, the healthier they are. Now, that's at a population level. If a country distributes its income more equally, it seems to lead to better health outcomes. And that's probably, although there's big debates about it, that's probably because societies that do that, it also goes along with better social policies. That they're a result of that. But those societies that are more equal have less crime and appear to have more cohesion. So this isn't just something that's about a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling. It actually affects when we live and die, so it's pretty crucial. And then the other thing that I think is a crucial part of this theory in thinking about equity is the whole question of empowerment. One of my fellow commissioners is Amartya Sen, who, of course, won the Nobel Prize for Economics. And Amartya has made his career has been thinking about how do we develop countries, particularly the poor countries of the world, and for his case, particularly India. And he says very clearly that it's not just about having a successful economy. It's also about people having control over their lives. And of course, the work that you're all doing is about exactly that. What's the name of this conference? Communities in Control. Well, that isn't just about, yeah, it feels good to do that. It also is absolutely essential to your health. Now, I just want to look at three bits of evidence on that. The first bit's about British civil servants. The next bit is about Indian children. And the third bit is about Indigenous people in Canada. They sound a bit strange, but just to show you that this control works in different settings. So the first is based on the research that was done, in fact, by Sir Michael Marmot, who's the chair of our commission. And he and his team have followed British civil servants over many years and looked at what they die of and what factors seem to be related to what they die of. And what he shows here is that those that had high job control, if everyone died at the same rate, they'd all be here. So those that have high job control, they die less than the rest. But look, those who have intermediate job control or low job control are much more likely to die. So what they're suggesting is that something like that's seemingly removed from whether or not you have a heart attack as to how much control you have at work actually works its way through your cells and predicts when you're going to die. That was done longitudinally, so they measured the job control before the people died, obviously. So one bit of evidence. The next bit is from an Indian study where they got children to solve mazes, children aged 11 to 12. And in one example, they didn't announce the caste of the children. So they were just children, nobody knew. In the other example, the lower caste kids were identified and asked to do the same test. Look at the difference in results. Just the simple recognition that you are in the lower caste. So just think about how powerful that is when we think of that translating into educational achievement. And then the third example is from Canada, where there was a consideration of why some bands of Canadian Indigenous peoples had higher rates of suicide than others. And everybody knows that suicide in Australia has a similar high rate for Indigenous people. And the researchers based in British Columbia looked at all of these factors, whether they had what they called cultural continuity factors. I won't read them out. You can see what they are. So, you know, for instance, with number 5, did the community have control of the police and fire and so on? And then they correlated that with the suicide rate. So on the right-hand side, if you've got 4 or 5 of those factors present, your suicide rate dropped. By contrast, if you're over here and you had none of those cultural continuity factors present, you had an incredibly high suicide rate. So I think that makes it very clear, as Pat said this morning, it's not a problem of Indigenous Australia suicide, and it's so often presented as that. You know, why do those Aboriginal people have a high suicide rate? It's actually about the most private act, taking a life, is actually the result of a public policy. And I think those data show it's about control. How much control does the community have? So, you know, I think that's important to remember that when we're arguing for the type of public policy that we want. And in terms of the Northern Territory intervention, as Pat mentioned it this morning, it seems to me it's worth reading what Pat Anderson and Rex Wild said in the original report, Little Children Are Sacred, because basically they were saying these are the kinds of reforms that we need to protect children. And of course, the intervention instead moved in with what Pat described as an invasion, and really could be seen as undermining many of those cultural continuity factors. And I think it's really important that Jenny Macklin and Kevin Rudd go back and really study that Little Children Is Sacred report. If you haven't read it, I'd really recommend people downloading it, because it's got so much wisdom in it. It's a fantastic report. Okay, next. What I want to do now is give you some practical examples, which I think are about shaping our own backyards through local action. And as I say, they draw on things that I've been involved in. The first one is about that issue of economic globalization, you know, us all marching to the tune of the dollar, and is about global resistance to that. And it seems to me that the only way that that's going to turn around is through local solidarity being built and then strengthened globally. There's some very key local global issues. For me, they're about things such as the privatisation of essential services, particularly health, water, power. It's about corporate wealth and power. Some people are suggesting there's a kind of new feudalism which takes power from local communities. And when you hear stories from farmers, whether it's in India or Australia, you can certainly feel the power of those corporations. I've already mentioned global inequities. And it's also about, of course, environmental sustainability. It's about issues of development versus the environment, of global warming, pollution, and the reduction of wild places. So those are the kind of issues that are at stake, that are inevitably global issues, but which have a really strong local face. And all around the world, I think there are challenges to this economic globalization. Through the People's Health Movement, I get to hear about many of these. And I think we can say in every country, even where freedom of expression is quite severely constrained, you will find people raising questions, asking how this really benefits my local community and what would the alternatives be. I think the power of local groups is that they can tell local stories of this impact. They organise and mobilise, and you can link globally. And I think the community sector, as Communities in Control shows very clearly, the power of the internet is fantastic. And I think those local stories, and I'm sure, I presume one of the reasons, and I keep the people I've been speaking to say, I wouldn't miss this conference for quids. You know, people keep coming back every year. And I presume that's because you get inspired by other people's work in other communities. And that's a really important thing to do. One example of social movements was in Cancun, when one of these amazingly World Trade Organization conferences, which are, I mean, they must be amongst the most boring treaties in the world, because they're full of thick pages and pages and pages of conventions. But in fact, they have a huge impact, particularly on poor countries around the world. And through the 90s, in lots of ways, the World Trade Organization carried on with very little protest. But gradually, people have organised and said, we don't want these talks to take place in secret. They affect our lives too much. We should be in there. And what happened in Cancun was that the African delegation really ensured that those ministerial talks collapsed. And that started from networks of people in their local community building up, linking with other networks, and finally, you know, it didn't just happen because of things at Cancun in that meeting. It happened because of years and years of mobilisation and action at the local level. And that's really led to a movement, the World Social Forum. Has anybody, how many people here have been to a World Social Forum? A few. Well, they're really exciting events. It really began as a space to debate ideas, to look at alternatives to neoliberal globalization and capitalism. And all the events, whether they're regional, local, they all have an international dimension. So the idea is you look at local issues, local events, and say, how does this link through to those global factors? And I was lucky enough to go to one in India, and it was just amazing to watch the passion of people when they talked about all these global economic forces that were having such a devastating impact on their life. And I think what's also very powerful about the World Social Forum is that it has this great slogan, another world is possible. So it offers out an alternative. And that really contrasts with so much of the rhetoric of the sort of neoliberalism that there is no alternative. We have to do this. It's the only way we can guarantee prosperity. So it really offers us a difference. My next example is about this commission that I've been working on. And what the commission was tasked to do by the World Health Organization was to put social determinants on international agenda, obviously to look at ways of improving health globally, but also to do that in a way that reduced inequity. And perhaps most crucially, creating a social movement. Because we recognized, I think as Rhonda said in her introduction, it's not a new message that our health is created from social factors. I know that very well from my work in Noarlunga with the Healthy Cities Movement. Local people know that it isn't necessarily health services and hospital that make them healthy. It's about whether they have a job, whether they've got good friends and so on, whether they've got access to education. So the basic logic of our commission is, what good does it do to treat people's illnesses but give them no choice to go back to the conditions that made them sick? So a fairly simple logic, and one that we've heard about, I think, last night when we heard about the mental health support. What's the point of giving someone good treatment in a hospital or a care facility, and then they leave hospital and the pets that were so important to them have gone, or there's no one they can talk to? We see that all the time. We know that. I think one of the things that the commission, I think if I had a dollar for every time one of us had said we don't just want a report that's left on the shelf, and we realised very clearly that if we were going to do that, we had to create a social movement. And we hope we've sown the seeds of that over the 3 years of the commission's life. And one of the most important ways in which I think we've done that is by welcoming in civil society as partners in our process. We think we're the first UN commission to so fully embrace community groups actually coming to the meetings, being commissioned to gather testimonies from people in different regions of the world. And when we visited countries, we tried to meet by and large in poor countries. This is an example when we were in India. We met with SEVA, which stands for the Self-Employed Women's Association in India, which really is a trade union for the poorest of the poor. They started with vegetable sellers in Ahmedabad who were completely unorganized, who were unable to buy from the big wholesale vegetable markets that were, by and large, I think, run by men. So they organized themselves microcredit so they could set up their own wholesale market. They had to fight for the legal right to sell vegetables as women. They then realized they needed childcare, so the women organized their own childcare. They then realized they wanted their own health service, so they organized through a self-insurance scheme to have their own health service. Then they thought, we need better housing, and SEVA women organized their own housing. Then as they got older, they thought we needed pensions. And then finally, we went to a meeting of the bank where these women who really are the poorest of the poor in Indian society were the board of directors of the bank. And at the moment, perhaps most crucially, they've been advocates and sponsors for a social security bill that's going through the Indian Parliament so that women won't have to keep fighting for these rights, but they'll be guaranteed by the state. So we really sought out examples like that to look at and say, what's the key issue there? And of course, once again, one of the key issues was about control of women being given control over their lives. So in September, our report will be published called Closing the Gap in a Generation, Equity Through Action on the Social Determinants of Health. And we say very clearly that health is important because it's a human right. Not as many UN and World Bank reports have said in recent years, health is good because it's good for economic development. We actually say that's true too, but we also say there's a fundamental human right that people have to the conditions that create health. And we also recognise, and we have a section called Money, Resources and Power, where we recognise that achieving that right is going to require reallocation of money, resources and power. And I think that's going to be quite challenging for some agencies, and our report is going to need a lot of support and a lot of voices from those voices that are usually unheard to make sure that it keeps coming up in UN circles. And we're very aware that it's going to be local social movements, like many of you here, that are going to support that shift. All right, my next example is from Adelaide, from my local residents group. I live in a suburb called Henley Beach, and we have a very active group called the Western Coastal Residents Association. And I want to recognise that I picked this group because I know them, because my partner's the vice president, and I, at the weekends I spend time with this group. But I know that many of you come from similar groups in your local community and that you're all busy taking action too. The examples, what I want to do is just give you four examples of work that this group's done, because I think when you only give one, you don't get a sense of the holistic one. And I think in each one, you'll see that they do relate to these global issues. So the first one was an unsuccessful protest against changes to the coast. The next one is about community arts. The next one is about a general move to protect the Gulf of St. Vincent, which is where Adelaide's based on. And the third one is about electricity prices in the era of privatisation. So those of you who know Adelaide, you probably know Glenelg, where the tram from the city goes. And the proposal was to build a sea outlet from the Patawalunga out to West Beach and so take a lot of polluted water. And then just by that sea outlet, build a boat harbour. And just to show you, there's the coast before the boat harbour. And there's West Beach, also before the boat harbour. And notice what a lovely wide beach it is. Here's that same coast after the boat harbour, as predicted by the Residents Association. Here's another view, and here's another view. And there's a final view. So you get the picture of what we were fighting for, and that effect on the coast. Well, the Residents Association listened to the many expert reports, and there were the experts who were most believable were predicting that outcome. So we had a community campaign, awareness raising, lots of media. We had a blockage of the boat harbour building site. We had a tree of local people that started with the sea eagles down to the pelicans, down to the seagulls, down to the terns, who would use a phone tree to ring each other every night and say, well, the building workers are coming tomorrow, so you have to be down there. And we had a clock which in Henley Square, which was counting down to when the community action needed to stop the Barclay outlet from being constructed. When it was, we organised residents to make a big no. This was photographed from the advertiser helicopter. And there was a series of community blockades. You can see there the police cars lined up to control us, protesters being dragged away. But you can see, and you'll see from that crowd, that there's children, older people, every age. And our president, a guy called Jim Douglas, who's a real local hero, made sure everybody was trained in non-violent resistance, and there's a good example of it. And at the time, John Olsen was premier. You can see there people had John Olsen masks on with that dollar sign. So you can see how those issues of economic rationalism come down to very local issues. And here's, I think, our community idol, Jim Douglas, who's our president, and that's a story that was run in our paper on one of the worst days when that beautiful beach had so clearly been destroyed. It's interesting, I think, to look at global links. We were supported in the campaign by David Suzuki. You can see there that the advertiser headlined that story that he said Australian stance is embarrassing and he expressed horror at what was happening. It didn't actually make any difference, but I think it was quite reaffirming for the community to have that happen. And then in terms of what it achieved, well, we didn't stop the boat harbour, we didn't stop the outlet, but there was a lot of education, I think, in the community. We did expose the lack of democratic process in dealing with those decisions. Many, many skills were developed, friendships formed. It was very uniting for the community in a way that still carries through today. And I think people still talk about that protest, even though it's 10 years on, and still feel, even though we failed, it was good that we made such a point about it. Probably also because we're proved right. It's always a good feeling, isn't it? Just to give a more positive view, more recently we've had South Australia has a Living Arts Festival every year, and the Residents Association led a group of making mosaic sea creatures, which involved particularly a lot of children and their families in the community. Those mosaics were then placed on the seafront and make for a very nice walk and a sort of very nice reminder that community arts have an important place. Yeah, that's quite a statement about the snapper is under threat in the Gulf. So there we go. And then again, a global local link, World Environment Day in 2006. Gulf St. Vincent has a very fragile ecosystem that's being increasingly threatened. And we use the occasion of World Environment Day to organise, again, a sort of public fair that enabled people to come and hear about that pollution, hear about the threats. That was very important. And then finally, electricity privatisation. The Residents Association organised a Power to the People, what a great title, to look at that issue. South Australia was promised when we privatised our electricity supply that electricity prices would go down. Can anyone guess what's happened? Yes, no prizes for that one. So we had a great community meeting again. We had the minister, Jay Weatherall, was there, a local member, used it as an occasion for advertising, selling the story. And we were particularly responding to a report that probably, I mean, many of you would be aware of this impact, but there'd been a report on the impact of those electricity price rises, particularly on people with chronic illness and disability, and the way they weren't able to heat their homes or keep cool in the summer, and actually documenting how that increased hospital admissions. So, you know, the effects of the privatisation in some ways were shifting the cost onto the state by people not being able to afford local electricity. So just in terms of those local environment campaigns, they really gain strength, I think, from global movements, being part of a network of local activists. Information sharing is made possible by the internet. I know my partner at the moment has a complete bee in his bonnet about jet skis, and he's always on the internet looking at what other local groups are doing and linking up with those. It really builds grassroots support for these global issues, and that eventually trickles through to movements like the World Social Forum. It's because people are active locally that those big global events happen. And of course, it builds those local networks. Then my final example is the People's Health Movement. I'm currently co-chair of our global committee, and it's really a network of networks of organisations around the world. We were formed in 2000 after the first People's Health Assembly. We currently have a secretariat based in Cairo, and we have very many country circles who are advocating for health as a human right. You can see the web address there, but if you put People's Health Movement into Google, you will also find it. And particularly at the moment, we have a focus on against privatisation of services essential to health. The basic philosophy is specified in the People's Charter for Health, which we've had translated into 33 languages, so it's as accessible as possible. And that's been a really important tool for lobbying and advocacy, because it makes a very strong statement about what conditions make for health. And we clearly take a strong view on health as a human right. And most often when we meet, we'll combine people's stories about their lives with academic analysis of what's happening in the world. And it's very often an alternative story. That People's Health Charter was developed in Bangladesh in 2000, but through it was in December 2000, but through the whole year there were debates, discussions going on in countries through Latin America, you know, in Nicaragua, in community health centres in Nicaragua, Ecuador, Mexico, Indian villages without any electricity, South African townships and so on. And everyone came together in Bangladesh and endorsed that charter. And we had another health assembly in Ecuador in 2005 that again was about solidarity building and people building their fortitude for these struggles. We currently have a global right to health campaign, and that's very much not just about the right to health services, but about the right to the conditions that make health. Cape Town, South Africa had a great launch for their campaign, and as you see from that, people were very clear that it's factors such as housing that will make them healthy or not healthy. And at that launch, they had a speaker from Abe Shula, who came from the Indian People's Health Movement, who was able to talk about their campaign in India, where they've held a series of tribunals putting the Indian government on trial in terms of how well they have met human rights obligations in terms of health. Now, for me, and I was glad to hear Pat mention primary healthcare this morning, that whole movement was inspired by Alma Ata, which was a combination of WHO and UNICEF, producing the wonderful vision of health for all by the year 2000, and talking of the importance of community health services and primary healthcare services. One of my great heroes is Halfdan Mahler, and I'm going to quote from him again in a bit, and I was so delighted to finally meet him in 1998 when we had a 20th anniversary of Alma Ata. And this year it's the 30th anniversary, and I think Halfdan would say we're as far away than ever as health for all. You know, when do we say now, health for all, when? And the People's Health Movement says very clearly, health for all now. We don't want to wait any longer. But in Australia, and I think one of the best examples of comprehensive primary health care are the Aboriginal Controlled Health Services, and I do work with the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress, which I think is a model primary health care service. And I'm sure many people might label them terrorists as well, but I would remind people that, of course, Nelson Mandela was once seen as a terrorist. It just depends, a saint or terrorist, it depends on which way you look at it. What I find frustrating about a service like this is they have to spend so much of their time being micromanaged by OATSI in Canberra, and I'm sure many of you have that experience too. The accountabilities are ridiculous for the kind of services that you're offering, and I think we've really got to get away from that and start funding services like this, which are community controlled, based on trust, not regulation. And then finally, I mean, my vision of community health, which I think would do a great wonder for all of us, is services with local management that are multidisciplinary, where people are seen as citizens rather than consumers, so we don't use the market model, that place where we have debates about how we want to spend our health money rather than on the front page of The Age or The Advertiser or the Sydney Morning Herald. They would look for collective rather than individual solutions. They would focus on local action and advocacy. And they'd be supported by a public sector that was committed to empowerment and a citizen's voice, rather than committed to just regulating and watching. And imagine if we could have that as the basis of our health system. It would be wonderful. Okay, so finally, to conclude, I just want to think now about what the new agenda needs to be. And here I just want to allow me to quote from one of my heroes, Halfdan Mahler, when he was speaking at the World Health Assembly last month. And I think he's becoming very worried, and he's saying that we all have to become partisans in renewed local and global battles for social and economic equity in a spirit of distributive justice. I think that's a very powerful message from someone who'd hoped they'd done that 30 years ago and feels that the world's gone backwards in that 30 years. And, you know, again, in terms of Mandela's words, inequity and poverty are not part of how the world is. It's not inevitable. It's actually a consequence of the decisions that we make. And I think that's a very powerful message. So it seems to me that we've really, in the 21st century, got to stop seeing, we've got to accept that an interventionist state that controls markets and regulates threats to health and well-being is essential. We've got to look at global governance to control the market, and we've got to look at creating conditions for local democracy in the exercise of citizenship, whether that's public spaces to meet, whether it's internet spaces, and the protection of rights of citizens to do that. And we have to support poor communities to develop the skills and abilities with a range of resources. And we have to remember that inclusion is about sharing power more equally, not just a fuzzy feeling. Exclusion often benefits the included, and changing that will be a struggle. It's nothing new to you guys, I'm sure. What seems to be new, though, is the urgency of responding to these growing inequities and the environmental threats. And I've got no doubt that, you know, we can do that struggle in our collective backyards. Globalization can be harnessed to support local struggles, just as it also poses great threats. But most crucially, communities need support from governments, both globally and locally, to address those power imbalances. With this support, a more sustainable and just world is possible, and a world in which communities really do control their destinies. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this highlight from the Communities in Control Library. If you did, we'd love you to rate or review this podcast in the iTunes Store and for you to share it with your friends. For further information about Communities in Control, visit communitiesincontrol.com.au.